most of you are staff and know each other, but we also have visitors here. We did invite our friends from the Washington science community. And so during the last session, we had some great lively discussion among these two groups and with our speakers. So I'm hoping that that happens again. Communicating with our audiences, as many of you know, has always been a high priority here, mainly to influence the impact of the work that we do. But over the last 4 or 5 years, our leadership has been putting more and more resources, and as you can tell from the festivities today, we have a lot of resources into communications, more resources and more emphasis on making sure that communicating to our audiences is both professional, high quality, and so that in the end, our communicating with our audiences is effective. One of the roles of the Office of Communications is to make sure that everybody in the organization, and by everybody I mean people from the program staff and communications and all around the institution, have access to opportunities to learn from others, and then to be able to apply the knowledge that we learn to the work that we do here, and the work that we do here in engaging audiences. And by audiences, when we're talking here about to the internal staff, we're talking about audiences that range from our core sponsors, who you probably do a great job of communicating with now, but all the way then to the science-loving public or the science-interested public. Prior fairs showcased communications activities that happened within the academies. And those of you who have joined us in prior years know that you've gone to tables and learned from each other. But what we decided to do this time is to look outside and to provide outside speakers so that we can get inspirational examples and ideas from them that we might think about applying to our own work here within the academies, and to make really the outreach efforts in the future even better. Our speaker today, the noontime speaker, is Phil Plate, and he has generously volunteered his time. Those of you who are coming to the afternoon talk, they are Hollywood people, and they are actually volunteering their time as well. So everyone, in the spirit of the volunteerism of this institution, is here to talk with you today. Also to take questions. I want to tell you that the Office of Communications, along with staff development programs and all of the divisions and communications groups around the institution, are all co-sponsoring this for you today. So long list of people to thank, which I won't do because I want Phil Plate to have more time. But I do want to thank Ann Merchant from the Office of Communications, who conceived of this activity today and has led it throughout. And Ann is in the back of the room, the green jacket. But so the session, the noontime session that we have today is called Information and Misinformation at the Speed of Light. And the format for this is one speaker, Phil Plate. And the format is that he will talk for half an hour or 40 minutes. So I don't need to do a lot of moderation here, but if it starts to go longer than that, I will...
let me continue to speak.
No. We have signs in the back that say, wrap up. I want to make sure that we have plenty of time for questions, because I want this to be a conversation, and that's really good for us to be able to have a discussion. So I'm going to do a quick intro and then invite Phil up here. Phil is an astronomer, author, and skeptic whose blog... Bad Astronomy is consistently ranked among the most popular online science columns. He's president of the James Randi Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization founded by magician and skeptic James Randi, whose most memorable accomplishment was debunking Uri Geller's claim that he could bend spoons and keys with his mind. Today, the foundation is charged with educating the public and the media and the dangers of accepting unproven claims. Its aim is to promote critical thinking by reaching out to the public and the media with reliable information about the numerous paranormal and supernatural ideas that are so widespread in our society today. Phil himself is a long time has a long history of debunking pseudoscience by clearing up misconceptions, most often in space science and astronomy. He brings greater visibility in science to science in general. Today he's going to talk about how blogging, online media, and Twitter, and he'll probably explain what Twitter is to those of you who don't know what that is, have been able to spread science information and unfortunately as well as misinformation to millions of people in a blink of an eye. So, Phil, I invite you up. Thank you.
Thank you. This one's live? Okay. Welcome to the smart-ass session of the day. That'll be me. It's always great to come back to D.C. I grew up here, and it's great to be back in the summer to remind me exactly why I left. This is pretty mild weather we're having, but it's nice to get away from the rain we're having in Colorado. So when I was asked to be a part of this, and she said, let's talk about communicating science online, blogging, using Twitter, using the online social networks. And I thought, well, how much does the National Academy of Sciences do that now? The answer is not so much. And so I'll be talking about that. It's an interesting way of spending your life. I people ask me what I do, and I think, you know, my initial answer is, well, I'm an astronomer. That's what I've been doing all my life. And that's not really true anymore. I don't do research astronomer. Now I'm a blogger. And that's really, you know, and president of the JREF, the James Randi Educational Foundation. And so that's sort of what I do, but I work at home. I have, you know, I hardly ever leave the house anymore. I'm sort of the definition of you know, the geek who stays at home and doesn't do anything. So in fact, you know, putting on a tie is wonderful. It's a change from, you know, mostly not wearing pants around the house all the time. My mom is very proud. When I was a kid, science communication was really just on television. There were a handful of television shows that would take care of this. You know, Mr. Wizard or whatever was on like that. And books. And so I would go to the library and I'd read books. Imagine that now, telling somebody to do that. But that has changed significantly. I don't know, and I don't think it's possible to get good statistics on where people are getting most of their science these days, because it's such a broad question. You'd have to really drill down and figure out what it is that people, when you're saying, where are you getting your science? What do you mean? Am I getting my science information, my science entertainment? You know, I'm going to see movies. What is it that you're talking about when you're talking about science? Well, certainly a lot of that is coming online now. How many of you are familiar with this picture, right? Basically, you know, most of you. It's the Pillars of Creation, the Eagle Nebula. This is a picture that was taken not too long after Hubble Space Telescope was launched. And it on its own, revolutionized astronomy. I mean, you're looking at an image that revolutionized astronomy. It was just done by a couple of professors who were interested in studying where stars are born. It's a nebula that's easily seen with binoculars, but not in this much detail. And it got picked up, you know, and it was on the cover of Time magazine. It's on a postage stamp now. It's everywhere. And it's kind of funny because now, 10 years later, something like that, it's not as popular as it once was. We have much more beautiful and much more interesting pictures that have taken its place. But it doesn't change the fact that this picture, because of its stunning beauty, really changed the way people do astronomy online. Because when this thing hit the web, it hit it like a bomb. People were picking it up, downloading it. People were seeing themselves in it. If you look carefully, you can see Jesus in it. It's actually, he's in here someplace. I can't remember exactly where. I, of course, see a Scottish Terrier with its hands up there, and there's an eagle beak and a couple of cats, and there's a buffalo head here. But people, you know, I see also Abe Vigoda here sideways. People say you read in what you're experienced with, and people who are religious see Jesus. I see Abe Vigoda. That's my own problem. But it resonated with people, and it really made a lot of astronomers understand that we have a very powerful medium here and we have a very powerful message. There were a lot of people who didn't like it who said, oh, the colors are all wrong and it's dumbing down the science and all this. And it's like, it's not dumbing down the science. If you're not getting any science, how is that possibly dumbing it down? If I'm giving you any science at all, that's good. And if people look at this picture and say, wow, then that's good. So when the web started off, it was pretty small. Only a few people were using it. In astronomy, I would argue, of all the sciences, really came in strong with the web before a lot of the other sciences did, because we're mostly a visual science. And there were two big events that happened. And one is that in 1994, the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 hit Jupiter over and over again. And as pictures were being released by observatories around the world, and including Hubble, the web was ground to a halt. People were trying to download these 100K images, and you know, the inner tubes couldn't handle it, and got all clogged up. And I remember trying to get the pictures from the observatories, and it was almost impossible because they were taking forever to download. The second event was in 1997 when Mars Pathfinder landed on Mars. NASA, totally blindsided by this. I believe that page got over 1 billion page views in just a short period of time. Again, you could feel it on the web. If you were trying to go to any website, it was slow because everybody was trying to steal electrons from NASA. It was pretty intense. And since then, of course, there's been more and more and more, and the web has really expanded since then. In those early days, individuals were quick. Individuals are always more flexible than big, ossified, fossilized, monolithic corporations. And so when I was at a university, it was easy for me to start a web page, which had hyperlinks in it. Ooh, yeah. Actually, I heard somebody non-ironically mention hyperlinks the other day, and I thought, really? Hyperlinks? But we were able, as individuals, to come right in and write up a web page and say, this is what I want to talk about, whereas other groups were not so good at it. Companies were very slow to get on the web, of course, and by that I mean commercial corporations. But now you look at eBay and Amazon and all these guys, they're all over the place. And, of course, it's been excellent for Nigerian princes. NASA has always been right there on the web. They've done a pretty good job at making their presence well known. I'm going to rag on NASA a little bit here. However, they've not been the best at doing it. I still think their website is a disaster. I thought it's always been a disaster since square one. But the good thing about it is that the information is there. And they're super good in the past year or so about getting their information on the web quickly, and sometimes even faster than quickly. You can go to nasa.gov/NTV, and that gives you NASA TV, and you can watch the space shuttle launch live on your computer. And people are like, well, yeah, so? And I'm thinking, you can sit at home and on your box, your magic box, watch rockets go into space. This is so cool. And the other day I was watching the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter launch. This is just a couple of days ago. It's now orbiting the moon. It just went into orbit this morning. And I had the TV on to HDNet or NASA TV or something, and I was watching it on the computer. And listen, because I was typing on my computer and I have an Ethernet jack, so I couldn't physically pick my computer up and go into the other room. And I'm hearing it 30 seconds earlier on my TV. And I'm thinking, oh, that stupid NASA with a 30-second delay. 30-second delay. I think I can live with that for getting this information fed to me in my own house. Science on the web is huge. It is. We already heard a little bit about that today, this morning in the session. It's pretty amazing how well most groups are out there putting their information on the web, getting it to the public, making sure that people not only get this information but understand it. I will chastise the NAS a little bit for inviting somebody to speak who has no respect for authority. And that is, in fact, I went to the webpage for the NAS the other day, and I noticed under the activities, and I did a search, too, that this particular event wasn't advertised. And I thought that was ironic. Now, this wasn't supposed to be sent out to the public at large so much. It was an internal affair. But I had to make some sort of joke about the NAS because it's the National Academy, and I feel so honored to be here. And the more honored I am, the more uncomfortable I am, and therefore I have to make fun of them a little bit. In fact, their webpage is really good, and they are doing something. They're doing one thing that is, in my opinion, and I'm certainly hoping this is going to be true, is going to do more for science in the public eye than anything any jerk like me can do, and that is sponsoring the Science and Entertainment Exchange, which is going to be hearing about today. That is being run by Jennifer Wellett, who's a science writer, a blogger. She writes Cocktail Party Physics. Also wrote the book The Physics of the Buffyverse, about science in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which I think is a great idea. You want to talk about hitting people where they live, what they're interested in? That's a fantastic hook for talking about science. And the SEE has a blog And they do write on it. As a matter of fact, not to kiss anybody's ass or anything here, but Jerry Zucker's introductory blog post on this was actually really, really entertaining. I really enjoyed it. It was fun. And I'm hoping to meet him because I directed Airplane. So initially, I think science did so well on the web because the people who were on the web were dorks, geeks, nerds, me, you know, my people. We were on there because the web was still hard to navigate. You had to understand how to install your browser and get it to work and to display things correctly. Now we don't have any problems with browsers. But since the people who were online initially were the geeky type, we were sort of predisposed for absorbing the science that was coming out here. And I think that's why science did so well. Later on, the corporations jumped in, and then it became something for everybody. You could sell stuff on it. Kind of screwed it up for the rest of us, but that's okay. We can still find our dork hangouts. And, of course, the good news is that geeks still run the world. So that's the way it's probably always going to be now that we're sort of a web-based society. Now, the question is, how does this work? You know, it's easy enough for you to go online and read people's blogs or to download this information and for it to become sort of a one-way street for people to feed you information. But as we learned earlier, people learn better in groups. They certainly learn better or they get more excited about it when they're interacting with people. And that's something actually the web does, which is ironic because it is something you essentially do alone. Unless you're at a Starbucks or something like that, and then it's really irritating when somebody's doing it next to you. But in fact, there's a huge amount of interactivity on the web. One of the best ways to do this individually is by blogging. That's something I know a little bit about. The blogging is great because you are basically standing in front of a group of people, except you don't have to be standing in front of them. And you can say things. And in many cases, you can say whatever you want. Not always, but you can. You can reach a huge number of people this way. I should probably turn to the screen, which is great. Not every blogger can reach a gazillion people. The vast majority of blogs are only reaching a handful of people. When you write about the cute thing your cat did today, yeah, your mom's going to love that, but not necessarily everybody out on the street. The good thing about blogs is that they build a community. This is where the real power of blogging is. When you have people that come back, it's not just sitting in front of the television watching it. They can actually participate in it because there can be a commenting section. If you go to my blog, underneath every ridiculous thing I'm ranting about that particular day, there are comments. And it's people being able to say what they want to say. And then what happens is somebody says, I think vaccines do cause autism. And then 400 people swarm on them and say, no, you're full of it. That's not what's going on. And so there's interactivity between the community as well. It's not just me. And as a matter of fact, I'm fairly hands-off with that sort of thing. Blogging is good as well. You can present breaking news. A lot of the times, it was mentioned earlier that print journalism, a lot of these, television journalists for science, print journalists for science, they're cutting back their departments. Blogging is taking over that slack, a lot of it. There are a lot of scientists who are now blogging. I'm one of them. P.Z. Myers, who I think that's his name, writes for Seed Magazine. That's a joke. He and I we're joke rivals. He's with Seed Magazine and Science Blogs. And if some news comes out, we can be writing about it instantly. We already have the background knowledge to know about this kind of thing. And so it's becoming more and more instantaneous. You can get your science news online. If I see NASA releasing a great image, but they've made a mistake in it or they've done something I don't like, I can say that in there. I'm not beholden to anybody except me and the people who are reading what I'm writing. If NASA gets ticked off about something I've written, they can email me. And matter of fact, somebody just did the other day because I made a comparison they didn't like, which is too bad because it was a fair comparison. But I was able to change it a little bit and say, to be fair, I'll add this. And the best thing about blogging for me is that it keeps me on my toes. If I make a mistake, I hear about it from a lot of people. And a lot of the times, they may not be right, or they may be coming from a different angle, or they may be absolutely 100% correct. I have totally screwed up. I can go back to my blog, put a strike through it, correct that information, let everybody know I made a mistake, and that correction gets out there. It's wonderful. So I get to learn. As far as vast audiences go, I wrote, every year I do a top 10 astronomy pictures of the year. I just did my third year in December. And as of basically today, that page has had over 750,000 page views. So a lot of people have seen these pictures. And basically, I just find the pictures I like, write a paragraph about them, and then leave it at that. Unless I have some more insight in it, then I'll write a little bit more. But one of the reasons this particular idea, and I just came up with this idea. I thought, oh, you know what I'll do? I'll do a top 10 astronomy picture, see how that does. Right? And it gets a lot of traffic. The beauty of this is that it's got gorgeous pictures, right? But it's got my personal insight. If I have something that I can say, oh, I know the guy who took this picture, and I know that when he drinks too much, he loves to do karaoke and sing, you know, Miley Cyrus songs or something like that. You know, that in a blog post will get you a long way. We mentioned science blogging earlier today, too. There's a lot of ways to do this. Seed Magazine has the science blogs. Discover Magazine, my own outfit now, has a handful of bloggers writing. You can do this individually. It's very easy to download software and put it on your own website or to go to somebody else's website and blog on there. Universities are doing it, and even some national science agencies, surprisingly enough. You can do this yourself. It's very easy to jump in. You don't necessarily have to have a lot to say. You can blog once a week. You can blog 10 times a day. I typically write between 2 and 5 times a day. PZ Myers is 7 or 8. It just depends on what your audience wants, and you settle in. What I found is that when I go to American Astronomical Society meetings, and they have 3 press releases a day, and other releases of news, if I write 5 straight astronomy posts a day, my traffic drops. Okay, so people don't just want astronomy as much as they email me every time I make fun of the anti-vax people or whatever, or Oprah, which I did a couple of weeks ago, when people say, I thought this was an astronomy blog. Yeah, when I write all astronomy, I lose readers. So you need to mix it up. It's important. The next step of this is the social networks. And I hope you all know a little bit about this. I hope this is something you're not an expert in, because otherwise it's going to be a long talk. Social networks are basically their online communities. People can gather there. It's a watering hole. People can gather there where they have similar interests, and they can talk about these similar interests. You can meet other people who have similar interests you wouldn't necessarily meet, and you can meet people with dissimilar interests that you might not necessarily meet. As long as the people can interact in some way, you've got a social network. A blog is a social network. It's a small example of one. A better example would be Facebook and MySpace, which I'll get to for a moment. Why would you guys be interested in doing this? And the answer is, usually when I tell people, it's because your kids are doing it. If you're my age and you have a teenage daughter, she's desperately wanting to get on and do these sorts of things, and you're desperately trying to keep her away from it. But it's a good idea to be on this, to see what other people are doing. This is the way of things. You can be dragged kicking and screaming into the 20th century if you want, or, you know, we can, and I said that on purpose, you know, or you can walk in willingly. But I would walk in willingly if I were you. Once again, this is a huge community building activity, and that is what we're trying to do in science. We want people to get this science. We want to build a community of a public that is educated and interested in science so that they will vote that way. As we learned, again, people weren't really voting on science, or at least that's not what the mainstream media was talking about. And as a matter of fact, it was in many ways anti-science. When people were talking about creationism versus evolution in the presidential party debates. And so not only is the mainstream media not trying to promote science, they're actively fighting against it in many ways. If you can find a mainstream article that actually says, you know, here was this family that was trying to cure their son's illness, and they took, you know, homeopathic medicine, oh, and chemotherapy, and it was the chemotherapy that worked, yeah, good luck. It's they love promoting alternative medicine, and it's rare for them to promote, you know, real medicine. You know what they call alternative medicine that works? Medicine. And I have a lot of things I talk about when it comes to fighting people who are against science. The social networks are good because people come back. If you write a news article and you put it out there, people are going to read it and go away. If you open up commenting, they come back. If somebody else comments it and they read that, they'll come back. You're building an audience. You get to disseminate this information all over the world, and it turns out kind of fun. Turns out once you start doing it, hard to stop. MySpace and Facebook are these classic examples. They may have had a bad reputation at first, and they may still have a bad reputation in some ways. I still think MySpace is a disaster. The graphic interface for both of these sites is, I think, terrible. But they're fun. Once you get it, you get used to it. You can interact with people. You can create an interest group. There's a Facebook page that says Phil Plait for Presidential Science Advisor. A few months ago, that was great. That had dozens of people who were interested in that. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. On the other hand, the Science and Entertainment Exchange can have a page on Facebook and get many thousands of people involved. Science Debate 2008 can do that and get thousands of people involved. It's a great way of doing grassroots community building and getting people's interest out there. You can write blogs on these things. You can post pictures, messages. You can put music on there, anything you want. It really gets people interested in who you are and what you're doing. I grabbed this, a screen grab from my own Facebook page a few days ago. You can see that, you know, I've got my picture up here. People can post things. These are people who are my friends, quote unquote. I have no clue who most of these people are, but they're my friends. They probably all need rides to the airport at some point. And you can see it was Happy Father's Day and all these different things. There are different people who start groups or have posted things, and that becomes in here. Facebook will suggest people to me if they have some of the same interests I do. And so you can really get out there and build a lot of stuff really quickly. Once this stuff became entrenched, once it really became firmly rooted in society, people started looking for the next big thing. And the next big thing came a few years ago, and that was Twitter. And I was really surprised. Twitter came out, and at that point, I was joining every social network that came out because when you're a skeptic and you actively fight against bad thinking, you get enemies. Oddly enough, when you tear down somebody's belief structure that they've had their whole life, not your best friend after that. And so there was a guy who was following me around and signing up for every social network and then saying horrible things under my name. So I jumped on Twitter, and I thought, all right, this is totally useless. What am I going to be able to do? Basically, it's a web page where you can post whatever you're thinking, but you only get 140 characters. And as you can tell by me standing up here, I can barely say my name in less than half an hour. So what is Twitter going to do for me when I can only really say, you know, an average of 7 or 8 or 10 words? And then what happened was a gunman held two people hostage at Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. And I started tweeting it. Tweeting is the verb. Twitter is a noun. When you go to Twitter and you write stuff, you're tweeting. It's embarrassing to use these words. But there you go. So I was live tweeting the event. I was watching the news, putting it up on Twitter, and I started getting email from people thanking me because their company was blocking the news sites or they couldn't watch video or whatever. But Twitter was new. Nobody knew what it was. I had, you know, 10 followers, and they would email me and thank me about that. So it was pretty cool. And then I thought, maybe we're on to something here. And then NASA launched a space shuttle, and I live tweeted that. And that became very popular. So now I do that every time. I try to do it every time. I don't always get a chance. But again, companies block a lot of access to the web. And so if you're out there live tweeting some interesting event, it gets people interested. And in fact, Twitter is being credited quite a bit with what's going on in Iran right now and the information getting out. People have been tweeting about the elections. And as a matter of fact, I don't think I have a good screen grab here. No, I didn't do it. A lot of people are putting green overlays on their avatars on Twitter to represent Iran, sort of the way people had the purple fingers with the elections in Iraq. Here's my Twitter homepage. Grabbed it a couple of days ago. I actually grabbed it because I was actually preparing this talk, and so I said I'm actually tweeting about Twitter, and I'm actually tweeting about Twitter, and the entire internet's going to collapse into a black hole. But it's really cool. You know, sometimes I'm just screwing around. My family was playing Pinochle, and I can't stand it. It reminded me of the made-up game Fizbin from Star Trek. Any piece of the action fans here? A couple of people down their heads. Awesome. Okay. So this got a lot of popularity. I took a picture of a lamp that was a giant cone hanging over a table. It looked like a rocket engine. So I you can post pictures, links to pictures. And I said a Saturn V landed in our restaurant. I got a lot of people laughing about that. Tweeps are your peeps on Twitter. Okay. So I have my tweeps. And on occasion, I'll mess around. Marion Call is a woman. She's a singer. It turns out I met her on MySpace on Nathan Fillion's webpage. He's an actor from Firefly. And Marion's a singer. She's awesome. So I started promoting her online on my blog. And now I'm not going to take credit for it, but she has a huge online presence now. She made some joke about having missed one appointment. Now the rest of her appointments are falling apart. And I said, oh, that's like temporal dominoes. And she wrote a song called Temporal Dominoes. And it's now one of which she's going to be releasing that soon. So actually a song inspired because of tweeting. And in fact, She posted a picture of cupcakes, so I made the joke temporal cupcakes. I got a lot of email like that. What the hell are you talking about? So basically, when you post weird, funny things, you get a lot of people asking you questions. And again, you're bringing people into your world, right? You probably have no clue what I'm talking about here, but if you followed me on Twitter for like a week, you'd be like an old hand at this. And somebody would say, what's that all about? And you're like, oh, what a noob. Doesn't know about that stuff. That's really silly. Twitter is becoming very popular. NASA is huge on Twitter now. They have their own Twitter feed where they will post things like what's going on with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, when the next shuttle launch is going to be, what's going on. Astro Mike is an astronaut who was Mike Massimino. He was on the Hubble repair mission a couple of weeks ago last month. He was tweeting from orbit. So that was very cool to hear from him. Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is tweeting first person. You know, I'm now in orbit around the moon. That sort of thing. It's fantastic. It's really cool. Kids love it. The Kepler mission, New Horizons on its way to Pluto. Alan Stern, who's the PI for that, is tweeting about that. I have my own news feed, BA News. People were complaining when I was doing live tweeting of the shuttle launch that I was posting so much, it was pushing everything else off the page. And so I wound up creating a second feed for that. In other words, you don't have to have one voice. I have my bad astronomer voice where I'll talk about anything. But the BA News feed is simply for news. I also have a James Randi Educational Foundation Twitter account where I'll talk about our meeting coming up in a couple of weeks, or if something skeptical that's interesting that happens, I can talk about that as well. And there's software I can use to do this. And I was actually live tweeting the talks earlier, and I'm running late, or else I would actually cut out of the talk, open up software, live tweet that I'm live tweeting while I'm talking about live tweeting. But I don't have time to do that. But I did post earlier, and Adam Savage says hi. Okay, so Adam Savage from the Mythbusters follows me. He says hi. Kind of amazing how that works, actually. Today, I should say, I was checking this morning before leaving my hotel room. You can check trending words. What are people talking about? And you can see what the most used words are on Twitter. And it turns out that LRO Orbit was neck and neck with John and Kate separated. So that rocks. That is so awesome, right? Because John and Kate are everywhere. And to be able to get some NASA news in there at the same time is very, very cool. And in fact, during the Hubble servicing mission, we were just totally ruling Twitter. It was all Hubble and Orbit, and I even saw my old camera mentioned on Twitter. That was really awesome. Now, very quickly, there are websites where you can go to where other people can vote on things on the web that they're interested in. Dig.com is one, D-I-G-G. Reddit, R-E-D-D-I-T.com. If you see something interesting, you say, wow, Phil said something really cool on his website today. This is a fictional example. You can submit it to Dig. And then people can go there, and if they see it, they can vote up, thumbs down. They dig it up or dig it down. The more votes it gets, the more popular it gets. It rises up to the top. And then at some point, if it gets popular quickly enough, it gets moved from its niche page, space, general science, environment, whatever, to the front page of Dig, and then it explodes. And that's how I got 750,000 page views on that top 10 picture. It got front paged on Dig and got 100,000 page views in a couple of days. It's pretty amazing. So here's a sampled Dig page from, I think, this weekend. There's a picture of Buzz Aldrin holding a Buzz Lightyear doll, and that actually got very popular. I've been seeing that everywhere. When I snapped this, it had been submitted less than 4 hours ago and already had almost 60 digs. And you can see there's always an exponential decay of votes. You get a couple of things that have a lot of votes, and then it drops off quickly. On the weekend, it's much worse. There's usually one or two with a lot of digs and only a few. And you can see what's sort of in here. I cut it off, but on the other side, it'll say recommended, things that are moving up rapidly. And it's a great way of finding out what's interesting. What are other people interested in? If you like astronomy and somebody else likes astronomy, chances are some article comes out about astronomy, you're going to be interested in it too. So this is a fantastic way of getting news out. So that's how you leverage all this stuff. And there's a huge amount of leverage on Twitter. Grant Imahara is one of the Mythbusters. He's on the build team. And it turns out he was posting some jokes. And on Twitter, when you come up with a good idea, you can include something called a hashtag, which is basically just a single word that you link to what you're writing about that people can make, that makes it easier for people to find it. So, for example, this morning as I was live tweeting, I was calling it Talk Science, or possibly Science Talk. And it'll pop up in people's browsers if it becomes popular, if enough people pick it up. It's just a keyword that makes it easy. Well, Grant had made some joke about what bar scenes would be like if they were populated by robots instead of people. So he started a hashtag called Robot Pickup Lines. And I thought that was funny, and I thought, I can think of one. So I posted one that says, your lips say zero, but your eyes say one. See, now I can see all the geeks laughing here, right? That became the fourth most retweeted tweet of the day. So if you see something funny, you can basically quote it and retweet it. And I actually was beating out Ashton Kutcher for about 10 minutes. So that was, oh, that rocked. And so this is a tremendous way of getting thousands and thousands of people involved. And there's a huge amount of leverage between these two things. I can post something on my blog. I can post a link to it on Twitter. I did that this morning. It happened to be about alternative medicine, but it could have been about the gorgeous sunspot picture, the simulated sunspot picture that came out a few days ago done by Atmospheric Research Group. So I can post a link to it. And then I just wait. And at some point, somebody will post it to Digg, and then I'll say, oh, look, it's on Digg now. You can vote for it. And then all I have to do is sit back and wait for the money to start rolling in, basically. Because what will happen is I'll just get a huge amount of traffic from something like that. And it's a fantastic way of reaching millions and millions of people. Now, very quickly, because I don't have a huge amount of time, I do want to say that there is a lot of room for trouble. A few months ago, this little guy, Cosmos 2251, a Russian satellite, and an American Iridium satellite, part of the Motorola fleet that was done back in the early days of mobile phones, they had a little problem in orbit. Their orbits intersected. Now, that's fine most of the time because satellites are small and orbits are big and they're not going to hit each other. But it turns out that did, in fact, cause a problem. I believe this is an animation I took. You can see that these two satellites wound up colliding in February of this year. The collision was huge. You can see this is a simulation, obviously. And it spread debris out all over their orbits. And it spread debris out. There we go. All out in their orbits. This is a map of how that debris was spreading. This was huge news. No satellites had ever collided sort of head-on this way before. There had been some mishaps earlier, but not in such a tremendous explosion that scattered debris all through the orbits of these things. Now, I want you to take a look at these orbits and see that these were polar satellites, right? The orbits are mostly going north-south. That's important. A few days later... Oh, there's sound. A few days later, this video was shot showing a fireball over Texas. Just watch right here. Slow motion now. A daylight fireball. If this had been seen at night, people would have thought this was Armageddon. I'm telling you, it would have been the end of the world. As this is the only video footage. I was rather surprised with all the... video cameras people have. Now that iPhone's got a video camera set up, expect to see a lot more of these. I've been saying this for years. So the fireball was seen. Within seconds, people were saying it must be part of the satellite debris that had happened because it was only a few days ago. And my first thought was, no, can't be. It's been way too soon. That debris is still way up in orbit. It couldn't have decayed that quickly. But I put on my website, you know, maybe. But it was coming out so rapidly. The video was on the web later in the day, but people were tweeting about this. And then what happened was it got picked up very quickly. The online news sources were picking it up. TV news was picking it up. Then Twitter picked it up. And then there was a news feed on Twitter breaking news that picked it up and said, fireball caused by satellite debris. That got retweeted tens and hundreds of thousands of times. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized it can't be. And eventually it was too hard to fight because everybody was talking about it. And I just kept saying, no, that's not what's going on. It can't be. That fireball was moving east-west. And so it couldn't have been from the satellites. We also know that satellites compared to meteors, satellites are moving very slowly. They're moving a few miles per second. Whereas an incoming asteroid, and that thing must have been a pretty nice chunk of rock, you know, some you know, on a scale of a meter across, something like that, a little bit smaller. But that thing was probably moving at 10 to 15 miles per second, much faster. You can see from the video it was moving much more rapidly than a satellite would. And so I was everything I could do to keep posting on my blog and on Twitter saying, no, no, no. Eventually people picked up what I was saying, and it spread through the internet, and it actually had a positive effect. Not just me, but other people were doing it. So it is possible to counter this misinformation, but it's very, very hard. because people are out there spreading it as rapidly as they can. As powerful as a force as this is for getting science out there, it's just as powerful, if not more powerful, for nonsense, because people have a lot more tolerance for nonsense than they do for science. We talked this morning about why science, you know, what we need to do to popularize science. And the impression I got from what everybody was saying was passion. You have to be passionate about what you're doing. You can show a cool picture, but you know what? Everybody can show a cool picture. It's what makes it resonate with you that is going to make it important. When I say, oh, I love this picture and here's why. Because, you know, you're going to look at this thing, but, you know, look over here. Look in this little tiny part of the picture you never would have looked at otherwise. This is where the cool stuff is. And that's when people really connect with what I'm writing. And I try to be very passionate about that. And I think that's why I've been able to build an audience over the years. So completely contrary to what the National Academy probably wants me to tell you, if you're going to blog, okay, don't give away trade secrets. Don't say, you know, oh, you know, I heard that the head of NAS was having a big argument with somebody else. You know, you don't talk about that kind of stuff. Talk about the science, but speak your mind about it. Don't be afraid to do that. Of course, unless you get fired, and then don't blame me for telling you to do it. It's not just the science. It's you as a person. You know, I could be just any random scientist, but I'm also going to talk about the fact that my iPhone covering is pink. Oh my gosh, did I get a huge amount of email from? I took a picture on the web, and my iPhone cover, I've got a pink case for it, and I got, I don't even know how many people saying, really, dude, pink? Yes, pink. What's wrong with you? When I open up my backpack, I can see it. If it were black, I'd never see it. And so, you know, and you're laughing, right? That makes it funny. It makes it human. And that's how people connect. It's the humanity of the science. And give yourself that chance to do that. Be a little goofy. It's okay. That will bring in the people. Again, blogging is going to help you think an issue through there. I can't tell you how many times I've started writing something and then realized I don't have a clue what I'm talking about. Thought I did, but I don't. The feedback is going to help you understand these sorts of things. It'll keep you interested. People will send you emails saying, did you know about this? And I'm not even going to talk about, oh my gosh, podcasting, video podcasting, bulletin boards, which are great. We have a very active bulletin board for the James Randi Foundation. In fact, that's part of our appeal in the skeptics community is that we've helped develop a grassroots skeptics community because we have that bulletin board. It's really tremendous. So I'm going to urge you to take that one small step. To go out there and try this and see what happens. You know, talk to the higher-ups. Make sure you're not going to get fired or anything for it. But give it a shot. Communicate that. And people ask me, what's the future? What's next? And I tell them, I don't know. I really don't. But I do love where we are. Because imagine... Imagine... Whoa! There we go. Oh, you're probably looking at Cybermen now, aren't you? Great, because I'm already running over. That I have to make a mistake like that. Here we go. Imagine back in, oh, say, 93. And somebody said, you're going to be able to watch a rocket go to the moon live on your computer.
And lift off of the Atlas V rocket.
And imagine if they had said, not only are you going to watch
this kind of stuff
live.
A lasting return to the moon.
Come on, NASA. Catch up with me here. I was watching this live on my computer, that you'd be able to see it from the rocket's point of view. If you were to ask me what's the best idea anybody has ever had on the web, besides, you know, Nigerian princes and all that kind of thing, it's strapping a camera to a rocket. When you watch the shuttle go up, and I can make fun of the shuttle all I want, I will be glued to the screen because it's not the best quality. But when you are watching the external tank fall away, or you watch the shuttle move away from the external tank camera, that is the most engrossing, amazing thing. There's a 3-minute or 4-minute video of the solid rocket boosters tumbling back to Earth. No sound, nothing, just them tumbling back to Earth. It is amazing, amazing. And more people have seen that, I will guarantee you, than have seen my blog. And so that's what you've got to do. You've got to connect with the people, find out what's interesting, find out what's cool. You've got to experiment because you don't know what it's going to be. But that's how we're going to be getting science out to the public in the future. I guarantee it. Thank you. Okay. See, your mistake was saying 30 to 40 minutes. You should have said 30 minutes, and then I would have stopped. But so 40 minutes means 50. So there you go. I'm an astronomer, factor of two.
Can I go ahead and ask a question? So I'm sure I'm not the only person here who works at national academies. What kind of protocol would we have to go through to do something like this? You know, set up a blog for part of the academies.
Do you have a computer?
On days that I'm good, they let me use.
You're all set. No. I'll let the official word go.
This isn't meant to be relatively a provocative session. We have talked a lot about in this institution about not being part of the participatory culture and building community, and it is something that we are testing and trying to do, and I think. Are we all allowed now, as Phil suggested, to go out and start blogging about our work? Yeah. But we need to be thinking about these things. Really, Phil is telling us how far along this has come. And we are really not a part of it. We need to think about how we can become part of it in a way that upholds human rights. We spent 2 years doing a study for a reason. Make it useful to us and be part of our reputation.
Right. I'm not encouraging you all to blog about, you know, from the NAS, about the NAS, anything like that, just to be clear. But I am saying that this is the way things will be moving in the future. And I think that if the NAS embraces this correctly and not just saying, go, write about whatever you want, because that's silly. Yeah, that's not going to happen. But the tighter the control is, at some level, you've got to find that balance, because the tighter the control, the less the stuff is going to work. I think NASA is actually doing the right thing. They're letting their astronauts blog and tweet about this. They're encouraging the missions themselves to do it. And the thing is, you know, you got to be an adult about this. You can't just take free rein. And I do the same thing in my comments. I tell people, I have one rule about commenting: don't be a jerk. And that's really it. You know, don't swear, don't make fun of other people, don't insult each other. Just be adult. Let's talk about this stuff. And for the most part, it works. It only takes one person to ruin it, but you can kick them off. So I think that there is this balance here, and I think that's the way things are going to be in the future, too.
Yeah, most of what we do here is based on committees. And, you know, the products, so with these reports that we produce are done by committees, and they're reviewed. Do the fairly well, and then they're reviewed again, and so it's not you know, personal expression of our opinions is not really part of it, I don't think here, you know, but it's part of the marketing.
Sure,
it can be. And if you are saying that because your blog has got comments that nobody can, you know, that it's self-correcting, and
well, I don't know if it's self-correcting.
That was the implication. Yeah, of what you
it
said,
can
right?
be self-correcting, and yeah. A lot of times, if somebody is a jerk, a lot of people will jump on it. A lot of times, it will also spiral out of control. Mm-hmm. You do have to keep an eye on it. I will say that's the first time I've heard the word "work" and "committee" in the same sentence in a positive way. That's great. And again, you know, if it's not just every individual blogging about it, it can be, for example, the NASA template, where it is somebody who is keyed into what's going on, allowed to write about this and get the information out there. In days, Mike Massimino had tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of followers on Twitter. And that's fantastic, because NASA doesn't get much publicity. As much as they do, when you talk to the public about it, they really know very little about NASA. And so when they can connect to an astronaut who's in space or going to space or has just come back from space, it works very, very well. Ah, yes.
The way you've been talking about it suggests an emphasis on speed and immediate access and doing things faster and faster and getting more information out faster.
I was just talking rapidly, but okay.
Okay. But a lot of first impressions are often deceiving, and the way you've talked about it, it sounds to me as though the first thing that you get out there is in some sense the seed from which a lot of things grow. And that seems to put a high premium on getting the first thing out and making it right. And that often takes a long time. And so I was wondering if you could comment on this tension between getting it right and getting it out fast.
Yes. It's funny. I'm in a position in life where I'm probably the worst person to be talking about this. Because besides being insolent, also, as a scientist myself, if I see a Hubble picture coming out, I can look at it and basically in a couple of minutes be able to tell you everything you need to know about it. And I'll make a couple of mistakes, but hopefully not, you know, fundamental, terrible mistakes. There is a pressure to get things out quickly. It happens a lot, and that's why we get a lot of bad reporting. Also because a lot of journalists aren't familiar with the science. And so that's a problem as well. Sorry? It's just true in science in general, yeah. Well, it's always going to be a problem, and sometimes being the first isn't that important. With the Sunspot post I put up yesterday, it was actually 3 or 4 days after it came out. I just didn't have time to write about it, but that actually gave me a little bit of breathing room. I don't like posting something instantly. When I go to press conferences, I feel pressured to do that. That's why I don't go to press conferences anymore. To heck with it. I'd rather be fun and accurate than in-your-face, quick and inaccurate. And there is a lot of pressure for a lot of bloggers to get it out there instantly. And I don't like that. And so, again, we have to find a balance between being the first, which is really not that important, and being accurate and getting the information out there at all. And sometimes I find that being a couple of days behind the curve works really well, because people will write about something, and then I'll just wait. And then if I post about it again, people say, oh, yeah, I remember seeing that. And then they'll read what I've had to write. Or sometimes they'll say, oh, I've already read about that. I don't care. It's all these kind of things you have to factor in, and you have to play with it and find out what's going on. It's in a sense, this is an experimental science, and just you have to figure out what works best and what you can and cannot do. And I'll say that again for the NAS benefit so I don't get in trouble.
So I just wanted to point out that NASA's not like so advanced and enlightened that the management there said, you know, go ye forth on Twitter. It was the people. It was a young employee at JPL who did the Mars Phoenix tweet, and she's the one who decided to do it first person from Mars before LRO did it. And she's the one who made it personable and creative and fun. It wasn't like management decided that that's how NASA's going to do it. It was like somebody in their cubicle said, this is what's going to connect with people, and this is what's going to help our mission, and let's do it. And, you know, like you were talking about, you know, the corporate powers hadn't caught up with it yet because they didn't know it even existed. So NASA didn't have a law against it. They're working on that now, of course.
Right, yeah. It's always best to get in there before people notice. And in fact, it was Spirit and Opportunity who had, I think, MySpace pages first. I think that was the first social network instance of NASA being out there. And whoever was doing it with Spirit and Opportunity had them be like sisters who were crabbing at each other constantly. Oh, my sister's getting all the attention because she landed first. She found this rock, and I'm just over here, you know. It was very funny. And yet, you're reading this thinking, I just learned that Spirit is doing this and that. And you back up and you realize, despite yourself, you've learned something. So it's very, very cool.
And just to go back to opinions, you guys are saying you work as in committees, and you know it's not about expressing your individual opinions. But Twitter's not just about expressing opinions; it's also about getting out data. It's also about getting about facts. It's also about getting out information. You know, and is your personal life or your dog alter ego or your kid could tweet, you know, hey, there was an important breakthrough, you know, in aviation or in climate change, and or here's a report that just got released, you know, in Europe that people should know about. Like, spread the word, you know, and make it fun and playful so people want to, or funny that people want to retweet it. But, you know, it doesn't have to have, you know, NAS at the top to make a difference. Although that's a good idea. You guys might want to look into that.
But, yeah, it's true. And, in fact, having the NAS logo on it, that sort of branding, is really good because the NASA tweet actually gets retweeted a huge amount. A lot of followers, and if not everybody who follows me, I have, I don't know, something like 14,000 followers. Not everybody who follows me follows NASA. So if I retweet NASA, that's that many more they get. And when Adam Savage retweeted something I wrote, oh my God, that was good. So that worked. As a matter of fact, this morning I said, the one thing I learned from this morning's session is that the art of getting science out is passion, passion, passion. And I noticed right before this talk that Grant Imahara from MythBusters just retweeted it. So now I'm getting even more people reading that. So that, I think that's really important as well. Yes?
That's a great lead into my question. Actually, how have you seen have you seen good examples of institutions? I am not at this institution, but I'm at, you know, there's a museum complex down the road. And how
There are museums here? Okay. I didn't know.
So, but how have you seen institutions with individuals who are on Facebook or MySpace or tweeting? How have you seen the passion of individuals come through under the heading of an institution? I mean, how have you seen that well balanced? Where, because a lot of what I think people are interested in following blogs is they're following the ideas of an individual person, but if you're an individual person blogging under the the umbrella of an institution, then you have to balance that getting data out with getting the, you know, well, this is what I'm doing. This is why I'm so excited about science. Have you seen good examples of that?
Yeah. Discover Magazine and Seed Magazine, for that matter. Seed Magazine was the first. I hate to say that, but there you go. Seed Magazine's a great magazine. And they said, we're going to collect bloggers and let them blog under our umbrella. Discover Magazine has done the same thing. And when I talked to the CEO of Discover, and I said, yeah, I'm going to write about Doctor Who. That's just the way things are. It's my favorite TV show. He said, I love Doctor Who. And I thought, yay, we're done. And he just said, just don't get us sued. You know, don't write about something that is going, you know, don't say, so-and-so likes to eat live puppies. You know, that's going to get us in trouble. And I thought, well, I wouldn't write that anyway because I don't want to get sued when I was blogging on my own. And so those are the people who understand it. Of course, they're in the media. They sort of already sort of understand how to get the word out. Although I find that old media, and we in the new media love to call them that, typically don't get it, which is one of the reasons newspapers are going out of business. They took their content and stuck it online. And it's like, that's not what I want. I don't want to read, you know, I do want to read my newspaper online, but that's not why I'm online. The newspapers didn't get it. The TV shows don't get it. And that's why the web is doing so well, and they're not. And so I think that that's going to be true for these groups as well. The ones who get online and say, this is our brand. We are NASA. This is our brand. We are the National Academy of Sciences. And then let the people blog about that. And again, I'm not promoting this. I'm not saying go out there and do it. But I think that once you're established online and you let your bloggers, within reason, talk about this sort of thing, that's going to get the information out far faster, but in fact far better. You have to control the message a little bit, but you don't want to put a stranglehold on it. There are groups out there. I'm trying to think of other ones besides the magazines and other people who have done it. I'm sure as soon as I step off the podium, I'll think of 100 more. But there are quite a few, and there are a whole bunch that don't. And I would look to almost any newspaper site for an example of what not to do. They figured out that, oh, yeah, maybe we should have bloggers on there way, way, way too late. And that's one of the reasons they're not doing so well, I think. Or maybe it's just I'm aggrandizing the web because that's what I want to think, that we're doing well and the newspapers aren't. Nobody over here. Yes.
Hi. One of the things that concerns me, this is not specifically about Twitter or science on the Internet, is just that the Internet, because it's searchable and you type in what you're looking for to begin with, that you end up being surrounded by the information you already wanted to see. Could you comment maybe on how do we address the notion of preaching to the choir on the Internet, and how do we prevent, perhaps, if we can do that, from people being too entrenched in their own ideas because that's what they surround themselves with on the Internet?
Yeah, a few years ago I was trying to find the history of the standing an egg on end legend. You can only do it on the first day of spring. And every web search I did brought me back to my own page about it, so that didn't help much. So I was literally surrounded by it. As far as preaching to the choir goes, people always say that like that's a bad thing. And I say, preaching to the choir is an awesome thing because they'll forget about you. Choir's fickle. And so actually going out there and every now and again saying, look at the new Hubble picture. It's red meat. I love it. It's great, and it's a good idea. On the other hand, you don't want to just preach to your own choir. The context of that is that you want to be able to get the word out farther. And that's the beauty of all this stuff, because you're leveraging your own popularity with other people's popularity. And if somebody who really is popular picks it up, that gets out. The beauty of this is when somebody who is not necessarily a scientist sees something interesting. There's an actress on TV. I found out she was following my blog. She's not a scientist. She's just interested in science. When she picks up something by me, I get a huge flood of people. It's like, who are these people? And it's like, oh, they're just people. They're not the science crazy people. It's not easy to get the word out outside of the choir. But if you keep hammering them and you keep getting your audience bigger and bigger, it will happen. There are these tipping points. When I started getting about 2,000 or 3,000 followers on Twitter, my rate shot up, and now I'm getting several hundred more, about 150 more people a day. It's shocking. But it just happens when you finally hit that one point when somebody sees you, and then they can make your life actually either really good or really bad. But with these Facebook pages, with for example, with Marion Call, I said I happen to see her on Nathan Fillion's page. So, you know, I don't necessarily listen to folk singers, but I liked what she had to do. And now I've been promoting her. And so the more you're out there, the more out there you'll get. Maybe that could be phrased better. That actually sounds kind of dangerous, but there you go. One more question.
Once our reports are out, anybody who's familiar with what they say can, of course, say what they want about them and often do. I'm just curious, given that your area of expertise is astronomy, have you ever on a blog seen an Academy's report cited as either to confirm a point that's being talked about in a blog or to correct misinformation, given that we're supposed to be the definitive word?
The easy answer to that is no. How much time do we have? If that's it? Okay, no, thank you. But that's only because I can't think of anything specific off the top of my head. There are, of course, examples of that going on. But now with the NAS sponsoring the Science and Entertainment Exchange, and again, I cannot stress enough how cool this is, and letting them blog and say what they're going to say, I think it's just fantastic. And you probably will see more NAS stuff out there now. It's not the kind of thing I think that most people who read my blog would even know about the National Academy of Science necessarily, despite all the really good work that's being done here. It's sort of behind the scenes. I was talking with somebody recently who's a member of a big organization who does a huge amount of good work. I won't go into details. And he was griping at me because they give money to people, and these people don't mention where they got the money from or why. You know, this person's really popular and doing a lot of work, but it's because we helped him. And it's like, well, that's what you got to do. You got to bring it back. And so now I was talking to Ann earlier about mentioning the Science and Entertainment Exchange, and she's saying they're seeing traffic coming in because I mentioned it on my blog. And I said, that's fantastic. Wait a year. And then I'm going to want you guys to mention me because you're going to crush my servers and not the other way around. That's what I'm hoping to see. All right, thank you.